I'm looking forward to hearing about aluminum siding from Barry.
It's Don from Barry.
We don't care.
Yeah, it's Barry to us.
All right, let's just do this show.
Okay.
Hello and welcome to episode 55 of the Two Hosers Photo Show. My name is Alan, and as always, I'm in Tübingen, British Columbia.
It's
Tübingen, Germany.
Yeah. So,
and that the disembodied voice you hear is
Adam, as always, disembodied.
And on the phone from Barrie, Ontario, we have
Don Komarechka.
Wow, the gang's all here.
It's not Barrie, right? It's Don.
That's right.
But you live in Barrie.
Right. Let's get it straight for everybody out there.
Plus, I'm just finishing up his biography, so we don't want to mess that up.
Yeah.
So, welcome back, Don.
Thank you very much.
My notes say Don is back. Welcome, Don, back.
Welcome, Don.
I'm just going to check that off. We got that done.
Yep.
Perfect.
So,
moving on.
Don, you got a magazine cover. Go.
I did. Outdoor Photography Canada. Out now. Hard to miss. There's a big snowflake on the cover.
I got a copy here. Adam, did you get your copy?
I did. I got my copy yesterday, and I just read it about 15 minutes ago. I read Don's story, which not only did he take the pictures for, he also wrote the article. You're a published author, Don.
I certainly am. If my grade 12 English teacher found out, she'd probably faint, but I'm happy with it.
Okay, shouldn't you be on a better podcast?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm
no, right, there's not a better podcast, Don. It was a rhetorical question.
Wow, Don.
Oh, okay, that's right, yeah.
Sorry, Don, we're losing you.
Going through a tunnel right now, Don.
No, that looks great. It's a magazine I probably haven't seen. I've seen before, but not in a while.
It's only been out for a couple of years, I think.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe I just got caught in a lie, Don.
What'd you think, Al? I'm going to interview you now. What'd you think of Don's article?
Looks fantastic.
Did you read it?
Of course I read it. Are you kidding me?
You're big on researching your guests.
That's true.
Don's been our only guest. This is his third time.
No, we had Steve from Australia one time.
Oh, and you had Chris a couple of times.
Yep. Not to make you feel bad, Don, but...
Yeah.
No, I feel terrible now.
You know. I think we'll have Steve back on the show. By the way,
let me just say, speaking from the point of view of the true amateur, because I think that your article seemed to be directed towards, I guess, me, but also the more experienced photographers. It was written in a way that I fully understood, so I appreciate that, Don.
Thank you, and that was my goal too, to take something that's kind of a complicated subject and take all the the more complex terms and techniques out of it and just drill down to the core to make it easy for anybody to do.
I feel you did that, Don. I was impressed. But let me just say, once it got to the point where it looked like there was a lot more work involved, that's where I said, yeah, I'm never going to do this.
Yeah, it's time intensive, right? The whole process, taking the pictures is easy, but putting them all together in Photoshop is the complicated part. And I guess on average, it takes me between an hour and 3 hours, depending on what I'm doing, to finish a snowflake photo. But at the end of it, I mean, it's fantastic. It's well worth it, but you've got to make the time commitment.
Well, and anybody who hasn't seen it, I mean, check out the actual cover photo. And I think you can see that online, because when you told me you got the cover, I did a Google search for it, and I found what the cover looked like. And so
can go right to outdoorphotographycanada.com, and it's all over there. I've posted it on my blog as well. So if you're lazy, you can just check the show notes and go there.
And where's that? Where is the blog?
It's don.komarechka.com, but I don't expect anybody to be able to spell that. So hopefully that goes in the show notes, and they can just click a link.
Absolutely. We'll put a link on there. And you're going to hype this at the end of the show too. So...
Awesome.
We'll definitely get this, get people checking that out. I highly recommend picking it up. There's a lot of good articles in it in general.
Yeah, it's got some of the best talent in Canada as far as photographers and writers. And if you haven't checked it out, it's probably one of the best written magazines in Canada for photography. And yeah, I'm biased, but I've been reading the magazine for about a year and a half now, and it's been full of very insightful and inspirational photographs and stories too.
What I like the best about this is there are a lot of amazing pictures in there, like truly fantastic photos from people that you haven't heard about online.
Because yeah, a lot of hidden gems in there. And they make a point in every issue to do a photographer profile of somebody that might be under the radar and showcasing their work, and I think that's fantastic.
Did you see the coyote picture?
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen that, Adam?
No, I haven't.
Have a look at, like, inside, if it's your magazine's there, like page 3, I guess. It's taken in Burnaby.
Oh, really? I don't have it in front of me. It's downstairs.
Check it out later. And I highly recommend that. So a guy named Martin Cooper from Burnaby took a fantastic coyote picture on the railroad tracks. And that's just one example. And then lots of great articles. And, yeah, great. Congratulations, Don. That's a fantastic achievement.
Thank you very much.
You go ahead and finish your thought.
I was just going to say that I'll be in the next issue as well.
Wow, back to back.
Yeah.
Is it more,
it's like
more
the
macro?
Blue Jays in the mid 90s.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
How do you go about getting your stuff in the magazine, Don? Do they come to you or do you go to them? How does that work?
There's a submission place on the website that you can fill out, and it's difficult though, because I was talking to the editor and they receive, you know, hundreds of submissions a month. And of course, they can only, like, they've got their core contributors that will always write their same columns. And then they have a few places in each issue for submitted content. But he was saying that he has some of the absolute best images that he'd love to publish, but he's just waiting for the right time. People will mail in submissions too, and they just sit in a box, you know, waiting for the day when they might get published. But the magazine is only quarterly, so the opportunities for that are pretty slim. As with any magazine, you can put in your own submissions. You pretty much have to write it yourself or submit in your photos. And if the photos are great, but you're a terrible writer, then they have to hire somebody to do the writing for you. And then, you know, so if you've got both skills, then it makes the editor's job a lot easier.
I see.
Great tip. Adam, can you write?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. Okay.
How about you?
Yeah, I can, but I choose not to. Because we have this thing called television, and I just do that.
Yeah, it's awesome. It replaces all other thinking.
That's all I'm trying to say. There you go.
All right.
So what, Adam, what'd you shoot this week?
I really didn't. I really did not take many pictures.
Don, what'd you shoot this week?
I took a few pictures, somewhere give or take about 14,000.
You took 14,000 pictures this week.
About that, yep.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's move on.
Tell us about one of those pictures.
Okay. Well.
Whoa. Let's just tell us about why.
I shot some ski races.
Ah, okay.
A colleague of mine is the official photographer for Alpine Ontario, and I'll be doing some ski races for him later in the year. So I just came along and sort of got a feel for the way things operated and, you know, where you have to be and that sort of stuff. I rented a Canon 1D Mark IV for the weekend. Mm-hmm. And, cause you need to have a very fast, rate of speed, you know, frames per second to capture the ski races. Cause they'll blast by you from the time that they're in the range of your camera to the time when they passed you in about a second and a half.
Right.
So you just, you know, fire it onto whatever it is, 11 frames per second. And, then you just keep shooting.
So you normally shoot with a 5D, right?
Normally I shoot with a 5D, but it's too slow. It's only, I think, 3.9 frames per second.
Right.
So I'd only get like 3 pictures of somebody. And, you know, there's tricks to get. You want to get them next to one of the gates when they're doing the slalom racing. And so you need as many frames as possible, even though you'll throw most of them away. And that was about just a little bit over 8,000 of the pictures that I had taken in the past week.
And so, like you said, you want to get someone next to the gate. Why is that?
Because otherwise they're just, you know, skiing down snow.
Right.
You want them sort of ripping around a turn and maybe, you know, colliding with the gate and, you know, sending it off and spinning a little bit. And it's a little bit more action that way. But the time that that takes is just a very small fraction of a second that you can't actually time, whether it's just because the camera itself has shutter lag or it's not going to be lined up the way that you want. So you just have to spray and pray in a sense, and just make sure that the subject is in focus and in the center of the frame, and go from there and hope the camera gets the shot that you need.
So how do you achieve focus in that situation?
Okay, well, with the 1D Mark IV, it's great for focus. So it's on autofocus around the center points. So I think there's a setting inside there to choose the center 9 points on that camera to be the focus, and it'll autofocus through there. Okay. The camera itself is going to be on, I guess, what's the term that Canon uses for the continuous focusing?
Servo mode?
Servo mode, that's the one.
L-servo.
Yeah.
Right, so you just make sure that the autofocus is constantly triggering, and you've got your subject roughly in the center of the frame. And, you know, it's a 16-megapixel camera, so if you need to crop a little bit here or there around the edges to off-center the subject afterwards, then that's what you do. And typically you would leave a little bit of room around the edges just to make sure that, you know, you're not cutting off a ski or you're not cutting off anybody's head because right. The action is happening so fast.
And what about for... Okay, a couple things. For like depth of field, do you keep a decent depth of field to make sure they're in focus, or do you want them isolated?
Well, it was a pretty dark day, so I was shooting anywhere between f6.3 and 7.1, maybe f8 if it brightened up a little bit.
Okay.
But I was shooting at I was using the 100 to 400 lens.
Mm-hmm.
So shooting at 400, the background will fall off much faster, and it'll be a little bit more isolated for the subject, even if you're shooting at f7.1 or f8.
Right.
So that helps you. And the biggest challenge, though, is exposure, because you've got to be shooting in manual mode, and you have to have it just so that the snow is just hitting the right side of the histogram, but not blowing it out. For these shots, of course, I'm shooting JPEG because I'm just shooting way too many for RAW to keep up. And I shot 50 gigabytes worth of data, JPEG.
Wow.
I can only imagine what it would have been RAW.
Yeah, like 10 times that.
About that.
Wow. And so how many pictures did you get out of the 7,000, 8,000?
I haven't even gone through them all yet, but at least a couple hundred.
Good. Well, sounds great.
Yeah,
I'd be good at that.
Going through the pictures?
The spray and pray part.
Part of the challenge. But when I'm going on the hill, like I hadn't been skiing in about 4.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they send me on probably the steepest hill in the region. And it was really warm, so everything was just crazy slippery that day. And I've got to go down the steepest hill in the region with a camera in my hands, having not skied in almost 5 years.
Uh-huh.
So that was a bit of a challenge. I partway through, I fell down halfway down the hill and had to sort of reach out for the netting, and I caught myself with two of my fingers that are still sore.
Uh-huh.
Just about cut them off there. But
you broke your arm, but the camera's okay.
Exactly. Yeah, as long as the camera's fine, then I can keep going.
It's a rental.
You're in Barrie, Ontario. What's the steepest hill in the region?
I'm not sure if it's the steepest hill, but it would be Georgian Peaks, and the hill that we were on was Rogers Run.
I see.
And that would be just outside of Collingwood, a little bit over an hour from here.
I know Collingwood.
Great. I'm sure all our listeners do as well.
Yes.
Everyone.
Great follow-up.
World-renowned Collingwood, Blue Mountain Sea.
Great. Took care of that on episode 30.
Yeah.
So... Well, that sounds great.
And then for the rest of the shots that I had taken, I was lucky enough that we had a bit of snow falling over that weekend that I had that camera. So I went out every chance I had and I photographed the snowflakes. And that meant that, say, I went to bed at midnight, woke up at 2, shot between 2 and 6, and then I was tired.
This sounds like a terrible hobby, Don.
I know. It's awful.
2 to 6, wow.
But yeah, some of the shots that I have are the best that I've taken, so I'm not complaining too much.
Absolutely worth it. Yeah, I've seen some of the ones on your site, and worth getting up.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
How about yourself, Alan? What did you shoot this week?
Well, thanks for asking, Don.
You're very welcome.
I did mostly video again. It's been such a long stretch of video. I went and shot a short documentary for Chris Marquardt. About the making of the making of one of his episodes. So that's basically what I did. I approached him a while ago about doing this, and he was kind of skeptical. He thought that's not going to be interesting. And I assured him that it would be interesting to geeks like us. So.
And what was the response?
It was interesting to geeks like us. Absolutely. Yeah. People seemed to like it.
Not supermodels. The supermodel contingent did not respond.
No, it was partially to blame for the breakup of Heidi Klum and Seal, but I like to keep it topical.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to get, you know, Charlie Sheen kind of numbers on YouTube, but it so far so good with the response. So.
And it was very well produced, too.
Thank you very much. You know, I didn't want to say it because it would sound like bragging, so I'm glad you did.
I wasn't going to say it either.
Yeah, it was actually a pretty good time, and Chris was a good subject. Normally, he's very camera aware. Like, he's aware that what's going on. And for this, he was just focused on what he was doing. And so got to show a little behind the scenes of what goes on over there. So there, that's it. That's what I shot. I received my adapter ring so I could use my FD lenses on my EOS cameras.
I've got one of those too. Which one did you get?
Quinox something. Let me have a look in the drawer here. Yeah, Quinox for professionals.
Ooh.
So yeah, they check your identification when you purchase it, I suppose. But yeah, it was the adapter for FD lenses to the EOS EF mount, and I was really excited because it tells you do lose infinity because they have two different models. One with a little lens in the middle that allows you to keep infinity.
Because it corrects for the distance that's being placed between the lens and the camera, right?
Exactly. And then there's one without the lens. And I thought, okay, well, without the lens is like $40, and then with the lens is $60. And I thought, well, for $60, what kind of a lens are you going to get? So right. I will give up infinity and then just, you know, just to use the rest of the lens. But what they don't tell you is that infinity starts at 20 centimeters. So I thought, okay, am I doing this wrong? And I don't think I am doing this wrong. It's really not, you know, how wrong can you get? It's just an adapter ring, right?
So now every FD lens that you have is a macro lens.
I've now entered the world of Don Komarechka. That's what I've accidentally
Barry,
done.
Barry Komarechka.
Barry. Barry Domarechka. Yeah, it's kind of cool, but it's not exactly useful to me.
The shots that you did take, like for something that's up close, that's in focus, how is the quality overall that the lens is giving you?
It looks okay. It looks fine, but I really wanted it for video work. I was excited about being able to actually pull focus with a real lens. And I got to tell you, I can't recommend this for that, obviously. But the mount even isn't exactly as solid as I would like it to be. Like the adapter itself is all metal and it's very solid, but just the connection kind of leaves a little bit of play on the lens. And I guess maybe it's because the lenses are heavier, I don't know. But it wasn't what I was looking for.
Well, return it.
It's going back, definitely going back. So there's that. Adam.
Yes.
We got a new website up.
Yes, I've seen it.
We finally got it up. I didn't know if I'd get it up this week, but I found a little gap and got the new photos up, a slightly new design. And yeah. Don, have you seen the new photos?
I have. It looks fantastic.
Well, you're just saying that because you're in a magazine. But
and anything else might get me in trouble.
So Adam, we want to talk a little bit about that shoot because we shot that just before we left, before I left to come back home.
Yeah. What would you like to talk about?
Well, the best part was for the last 8 months we discussed we need a new Hoser's photo of the two of us because our original one we were not in the same room.
Correct.
We're not in the same continent when we shot that original one. And so I thought, let's get one together. And then for 8 months, never made it happen. And I was back for 3 months. And the day before I left, you finally, I managed to get you to come over. Not that it's your fault by any means. I was procrastinating myself. So you came over and we shot that in my dad's garage.
Yes.
With reflective umbrellas.
Yep, two of them.
Yep, not shoot through, which I just like the quality of the light better for some reason. Maybe it's me. I don't know.
I don't know. I usually use the shoot through, so
yeah.
I think it looks good.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I wanted to point out, the whole reason I brought this up is that we have new bio pages.
Yes, which I really like.
I've gotten some good feedback on that. I'm pretty proud of myself for doing that. I'm not going to lie to you.
I'm pretty proud of you for doing it too, because I think that definitely is the winner on the website.
Unfortunately, you have to be in your 30s and Canadian to appreciate that, though.
I don't think so. I think anybody who has who's had hockey, baseball, football, basketball cards of at any age would appreciate it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Baseball cards,
I think,
for sure.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very original.
I wasn't sure. Well, I did steal it from OPG, but.
Question though, where did you get the highway sign in the background?
I can't discuss that.
There's still a warrant out for his dad. It's his dad that they're looking for.
Huh? Well, I don't think so. I think it was found on the side of the road at one point about 30 years ago.
It's generally where they're found, yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, I did find another one on the side of the road, but more on the pole. But no, that's not true. This one was found run over or something like that. I think my dad ran it over like 25 years ago or something like that, or more, I bet. So Highway 99 is the main highway running through British Columbia, like north to south, as opposed to Highway 1, which you would take to get to Barrie.
I've actually traveled on that road.
Before you guys talk about too much more geography that's boring our audience to sleep, let me just say from a photography standpoint, that Highway 99 sign is ridiculously shiny. Mm-hmm. So the fact that that the setup allowed for that to not be shiny but still to get the light sort of reflecting off the skate blades is awesome.
That's true. Highway signs are designed to be very, very bright and reflect your headlights. So that was a little bit of a challenge for us to light that.
But look at right next to it in the skates, and you fully got the light coming off the skate blades. To me, I'm looking at that. I just noticed that right now, looking at it, going, how did that happen?
Mm-hmm. Luck.
Just magic. Magic.
Yep. So,
brilliant engineering.
Yeah.
So there you go. Check out the new website. Let's get into the photo challenge.
Okay.
What was the photo challenge, Adam? Do you remember?
It was complicated. You said have someone, I think it was supposed to be a spouse or partner or friend, someone take your picture.
Right.
And you were going to teach them a few elements of making a portrait. We didn't say exactly what those elements would be, but there were supposed to be at least two elements.
The elements were up to you.
Yes.
And it didn't need to be your spouse. In your case, I figured it would be your spouse, as it would be mine.
Yes.
But it could be just basically teach somebody to take your picture.
Okay.
So let's go with yours first.
Okay. So my wife, Lisa, did take my picture.
Dawn, do you have this up in front of you?
I've got them right here, yep.
Okay. Go ahead, Adam.
So the first thing she said was she wanted to take something with a blurry background. So I taught her about aperture and what would be necessary in order to create the blurry background. So she's using my camera, the T2i, with the 50 millimeter 1.8 lens. And so this was taken up in our bedroom, where it's relatively dark where we took this picture. So she ended up going all the way to 1.8 to get any kind of decent shutter speed. And so instantly when she started doing that, what happened was she was having a hard time keeping me entirely in focus. And the other thing that she really wanted to do was she wanted to have me be slightly off center in the picture. And so there's no crop or anything on this photo. So I taught her the focus and recompose with a 1.8 aperture targeted at my, in this photo, my right eye, left when you're looking at it. So that was sort of our target, was to get the blurry background, to do an f1.8 with, I think we ended up with a shutter speed of a 40th of a second, get my eye in focus, and then focus and recompose. So those were kind of the elements we were after, and she nailed it. I think she took about 5 shots, and we liked 1 out of 5.
Nice. Better than 100 out of 7,000. What do you say about
yeah,
that, Don? Yeah. Thoughts, Don? Thoughts on the photo?
I'm looking at it right now. I like the black and white treatment on that too. Really focuses on the eyes, I think. The framing, you're right, Adam. Having your head slightly tilted that way, I think makes it a little bit more dynamic. The fact that you've got your headphones on and the microphone in front of you, it's sort of showing an action, like you're doing something. Like there's a purpose behind you being there in the photo, and I kind of like that.
The context was, Don, that I was kind of like paying tribute to Al's picture from last week, because he took a picture of Chris Marquardt with his microphone at his computer doing his podcast. So I thought, hey, I'm gonna do the same thing, show my amazing setup at home for my podcast.
I see.
Right, so you're just ripping off of Alan's ideas then.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, kind of a little bit making fun of Al, saying my wife can do what he does, but...
Good point.
Yeah, same thing, yeah.
I thought you were giving out the poison Kool-Aid to all your followers. Look at the look in your eye.
It looks like that, doesn't it? Isn't
yeah.
it creepy? It's creepy.
I peed a little when I saw this. Yeah. So I wanted to feather that, like, how can I make fun of Adam but leave Lisa out of it, so...
Yeah. Yeah. No, I thought the same thing. I'm like, I've got to use this one because it's just creepy. It's eerie. I'm staring into my own soul right now looking at it.
You look like that the comic book character that Colin Farrell played. Bullseye?
I don't know it.
Yeah. You look like him.
Okay.
All
Bullseye.
Right. Bullseye. Well, that's...
Oh, I do know it. I do know it.
It's like basically that picture, except with a bullseye painted on your head, I think.
Yeah, he was in the Daredevil movie with Ben Affleck. That was
right.
Horrible.
Yeah, well, I saw the first 20 minutes. He was in the first 20 minutes, or I would have missed him. Yeah. So, other than that, Lisa, great job. And I got to say, honestly, great job teaching Lisa how to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Do you think Lisa could have achieved that on her own right now?
Absolutely not.
There you go. And that was the goal.
Yes.
So, all right. Have a look
Your
at
turn.
My photo. Yep. I actually had my wife take the picture, just like you did. What do you want to talk about? The techniques I wanted to talk to her about was composition, for one. I wanted to make sure she had the proper amount of headroom, but still included the bag in the photo.
Yes, that bag.
That's my new camera bag, by the way.
It's kind of a satchel.
Yeah. It's I that's where I carry around my 40D and my 30mm lens. Just goes right in there, no padding, nothing. So
looks like a purse,
a man purse. It's a man purse. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make sure she included that. We shot with the 70-200 lens. I wanted to make sure that she had perspective in the photo, meaning the poles that shrink off into the background.
Yes.
I wanted to include that. We wanted the
So you basically told her everything to do then.
I showed her how to do everything. Yeah.
Okay.
No, she told me, Alan, I would like perspective. and then she said, also, we have about 12 seconds before I lose interest in this. Those are my parameters. You know, and our daughter was sitting next to her in the stroller crying. So that really added to it.
You look like you have the stern look of a father there.
Oh yeah, I was about to give her something to cry about. Yeah.
Okay.
So we went over depth of field. We wanted narrow depth of field, which we achieved by using a 200mm lens at f/4. We wanted nice lighting. I didn't want to have her light anything. So we went like a nice sort of soft light at the end of the day, on a cloudy day. I had her position me sort of, this is a long, covered area. So I stood at the front of the covered area. So the light would hit me and it would get darker as it went into the background. And the last one, this was the most important one, is I showed her how to keep the camera steady, because you're shooting it, you know, with 200 millimeters handheld with no IS, you're going to try to keep that camera steady. So I showed her the stabilization on the body, and then the most important thing was I had her shoot on burst mode. Do you ever do that, Dawn?
All the time. Whenever I've got, you know, the chance that something could be blurry because the shutter speed isn't fast enough, I'll just fire off a burst of 10 shots, and guaranteed 5 of them at least are going to be blurry. But, you know, I'll get the one or two in there that are as clear as I need them to be.
Exactly. That's the move we used here for two reasons. One, which we've talked about on a previous show, but when you click the shutter, when you press the shutter release, even if you're the greatest ever and just kind of roll your finger over it like you're supposed to, there's still a chance of camera movement.
The first one's always blurry. The
first one's going to be blurry. And after that, hopefully you've steadied yourself and you'll get one that's sharp. And that's what happened here. The first one was blurry, but after that they were in focus. So there you go. That's a lot of parameters to deal with.
With 12 mm-hmm. seconds.
With 12 seconds. That's a good point.
And you're just that good.
I wish it was more than 12 seconds, but it wasn't. That was the gist of it right there. So, all right, we'll start with Dawn again. Rip on it, Dawn.
Your hair looks goofy.
It does. Fair enough. At least it's not for some reason, and I don't know why, doesn't look as gray as normal.
It's a bit of sticky uppy at the top, though. It's very sticky uppy, yeah.
Yeah, it is. Okay, besides the hair.
I don't like the fact that you've got a purse.
Mm-hmm. No, can I just say, I can't believe out of these two photos, I'm getting ripped on about hair.
I just want to say that the only thing I think that distracts me is that the post you're standing beside and your shirt are the exact same color or close to it. It would be nice if you found a different pole.
Or a different sweater.
Or a different sweater. Or just take the sweater off.
Oh. I don't mind the fact that you've got similar tones on the sweater and the pole and the background. It really puts the focus on both your face and on your man purse.
Awesome. Now, there's a whole bunch of audio engineers at CBC who don't think that's a man purse.
Right.
That is a mobile recording bag, but... Anyways, in my man purse is manly stuff, though.
I have no problem with your picture. Yeah. I like the light. It's a very even light. And, I don't know. I like the perspective. This is a kind of shot you see all over the place.
There we go. We've spent too much time on ourselves.
Yes.
Let's move on.
Okay.
Okay, this week's topic. Let's get right into this week's topic already. This week's topic, we're going to talk a little bit about filters. So it's a request by Janice, who is in, man, she told me, she's in Australia, Perth. I'm going to say Perth. Have we been through this before? Yeah, we've been through this. She's from Perth. She asked about filters. So we're going to talk a little bit about filters, because Dawn is a filter expert.
I don't know about that.
Okay, I'm not a filter expert either, but let's start off with what are filters? Adam, what are filters? You had to Wikipedia this as part of your homework.
No, I never looked it up. I thought I was going to ask the question, because then it would be a legitimate question. What are filters?
Geez, Don, why didn't you write an article about filters?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I can just talk off the top of my head. I don't know if I'll be right, but I can do it.
Oh, you don't have to be right. This is the internet, Don.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. Different rules.
As long as you're loud, you're good.
Well, filters, I guess you can look in two different ways, whether it's a filter in front of your camera or in front of your lens, or if it's a filter in Photoshop in post-processing. So it's sort of a vague idea. I guess we could cover both, though.
There is a difference between software filters and hardware filters. I don't think anyone actually calls it a hardware filter, but that's what we're talking about. And so let's talk first about basically putting something in front of your lens to change. You know, I thought it was a lot. When I wrote that question, I thought the answer was way more simple. But it turns out it's not. Basically, you're putting something, for instance, a colored piece of glass in front of your lens to change, you know, the color tone. Or there's other kinds of filters. But you're putting a piece of glass in front of your lens to make an alteration. So what's an example? What's an example of a filter? Like back when we shot, when I used to shoot film, back in the film school days, two filters we used quite often. Well, one we used the most often was called an 85. Have you ever heard of that?
I have one sitting right here.
There you go. It's sort of like a salmon color.
Yep.
Yeah. And that was what, because back in the day, we didn't have white balance, right? You bought film, like when you bought film for your point and shoot 35 millimeter camera. It came in either daylight balanced or tungsten balanced, which you can kind of relate to on your digital camera now. But that was it. You didn't have tons of choices. So if you're going to go shoot a short film, for instance, you'd buy one roll of film, 10 minutes of film. You couldn't switch back and forth with color balance. So you had to filter that. So your film would be balanced for inside. When you went outside, everything would be extremely blue until you put this salmon-colored filter in front called the 85, and now it's all of a sudden it's balanced normally again. Adam, are you still there?
So completely useless today, then?
I'm kind of listening.
I don't know if it's completely useless. I don't use it anymore. I have an 85 and an 80A that is the opposite. Basically, if you want to shoot daylight balanced film inside, you throw the 80A on. We didn't use that very often because once you throw a filter on, you lose a little bit of light. And when you're going inside, you want to have as much as you can.
Right.
So that's one example of a filter that I don't ever use. Something we also used to use a lot of, well, not a lot of, I guess, but when you shoot black and white, I would use a yellow filter for shooting black and white film.
And why is that?
It just kind of changes the color tones of, what did it do? It sort of brought out.
This is where I say as a parent, because I said so, Don.
Yeah, that's about right. I wasn't ready for that question. It's been a long time since I've used that, but you know what?
I'm just thinking that if you're shooting black and white, and let's say you're taking a picture of somebody that's wearing a red sweater, and
right,
you put a blue filter in front of the camera, then their sweater is going to look black. So the color of the filter that you put in front of the camera is going to have an effect on how bright or how dark certain colors in that photo will become. At least that's my logic. I've never done it, but I thought that's why I've got this bag full of multicolored filters for that purpose, because I couldn't figure out any other reason why they would exist.
Okay, that's the answer that was banging around my head. But I woke up at 5:15.
No, don't make excuses.
Yeah, that makes complete sense to me, and I wish I could have said it that way. That's exactly right.
We can rewind. We can just scrap this.
He's going to edit this out.
Oh, I'm cutting all this out.
I know he's going to edit this out.
There's going to be like just elevator music for the next 15 minutes. Yeah, it's going to be great. Great radio.
Put this part up front.
I still shoot. Yeah, we better lead with this. I still, when I edit in Aperture, I still use a software yellow filter on my black and whites. So we'll get to that at the end, though. We'll talk about software filters. So what's another example of a filter, Don?
Well, one that I use quite a bit is a polarizing filter.
And what is that for?
Well, it cuts out light that is coming off of a reflected surface that's not metal. So if you have water, if you have foliage, if you have even just water vapor in the air, it cuts out the haze in the atmosphere. It cuts out reflections on water or glass too. So if you're shooting through a window, you can get rid of the glare and the reflections a little bit with it. So it's useful to richen up certain colors in landscape shots or to allow you to shoot through things a little bit easier.
There's one effect that is my ultimate favorite that happens with the polarizer when you're shooting outside.
Darkening the sky?
Darkening the sky. It creates that wonderful, really rich blue in the sky, and the clouds just seem to pop.
I agree, and I use that quite a bit. Now, it can be overdone. A lot of polarizers can go way too far, and the sky will look way darker than you'd ever see it, and it looks a little surreal. But so with a polarizer, you can dial in the amount of effect that you want, from having no effect to the maximum effect just by spinning the filter in the front of the camera. And they're all designed to be able to spin when they're properly mounted. So you can choose exactly how much or how little of the effect you need.
And so what do they call that kind of a polarizer?
A circular polarizer.
I have that right in the show notes. Okay. Adam, you still there?
Yes, still here.
Okay, any other examples?
I should also say, too, that there is such a thing as a linear polarizer as well. And that, ironically, they are also circular in shape, because they would be meant to fit on the front of a camera, unless they were like sheets for like the Lee filter system. I don't think they've used those for a long time, because I think they screw up the autofocus phase detect in most cameras. So they've been disused since digital and since autofocus was invented.
Right. Yep. Most of the filters I used back in the day were the square box, like the filters that would fit in a matte box. I wasn't used to the round ones. I am probably just going to go right to being a grandpa. with all this stuff. I remember back then. Wow, I remember. But yeah, that's kind of where we started, with the big square filters that would drop in front.
You know, I cleaned out somebody's old darkroom the other day. They were just going to throw out pretty much every bit of equipment in there, and they asked me if I wanted to take it. And I was going to say, well, yeah, I'll take this and that, but it was sort of an all or nothing thing, so I had to take a lot of stuff to the dump. But I came across an entire box full of filters, and like you said, Alan, there's a bunch of the big square ones in there, and all sorts of different colors, and some filters that I had never really seen, like I've heard of, but there's all sorts of weird filters that really don't have much of a use today, but there's one that almost looks like a kaleidoscope that would fit on the front of your camera and split the image into three separate triangles.
Okay.
And you could spin that around and vary the effect. There's one that is...
That would be, like, for instance, I think they would use something like that at the beginning of Good Will Hunting.
Yes, if something like that.
Remember the opening credit sequence for that? Something like that.
There's one that actually has, for lack of a better term, a screen door built into the filter. So it's got, like, a square mesh. And that means if you put it over any like bright light source, you'll have streams of light coming out of that light source in squares. So another little trippy effect that you could probably do in software today, but in the days of film, I mean, it had to be done on the film in the camera.
Have you tried
these filters? Were kind of unusual to come across. I've never seen them before.
The mesh one is that's not for in front of the camera though, right?
Yeah, it is.
Really?
It's a circular filter that screws onto the front of the camera.
Oh wow! It sounds like what you're describing was like a scrim for a light. But wow, I've never seen that.
Yeah, there's all sorts of weird stuff in here. There's another one that's called a spot filter, whatever that means. And then I took a look at it, and it has almost like a matted finish around most of the filter, except in the center, it's perfectly clear. So that'll give you like spot focus.
These are. They're all from the days before you really had any reasonable post-production.
Exactly.
I mean, not reasonable, but accessible. Because back then, you had to do everything in camera. You couldn't add anything digitally. It had to be an all optical stuff.
Yep.
And so that's where a lot of this was done. I mean, you would have... let's move on. Let's move on to something that's practical that we can use now. So, Adam, what kind of stuff... Do you have any filters?
I have the flash gels, which I guess kind of act like filters. Same idea, right? You put the color for either correction or to create effect on the flash, and then the camera ends up capturing it when you take the picture.
That's very similar, but what's happening if you're using a filter is it's global instead of just on the one light source.
Right.
So like a flash, you're trying to, you know, perhaps introduce a one color in or balance the flash with a certain light. And this, but in front of the lens, it's a global setting.
Okay, I don't have that.
Okay, one of the ones that the filters that everyone's kind of told to buy is a UV filter.
Boo.
Do you have tons of, that's what I've noticed with all my photos I look at and think, wow, way too much UV in that.
I know.
Good picture. Good. Can I just Apple click UV and get rid of that? How does that go? Why do they tell you to buy a UV filter? Anybody know?
Because I don't. They make a lot of money on them.
It's a pretty high margin on something that you don't need. Now, I think we talked about it last week when I said the opinions on my show are my opinions. So I'm not going to every time say, well, it's just my opinion, but this is just my opinion. And I think it's a lot of people.
I'm a scarred veteran of working in a camera store, so I have a few opinions on this.
Okay, I'd love to hear it.
It's funny because a lot of the customers are almost trained to want one too, even before they come into the store. And of course, management and everybody else in the company wants you to sell a UV filter or as many add-ons to the camera as possible. So you're talking extra batteries, little mini tripods, cleaning cloths, and a UV filter fits in very nicely there. And it's a pretty reasonable explanation because you can just tell somebody that that if their camera falls and it falls lens down, then you're going to have to replace this $20 filter instead of replacing your lens. And most general consumers that don't know any better will trust you at your word, and they'll buy it and they'll stick it on there and they think that they've done themselves a favor. But in reality, it's just going to take a $20 piece of glass and put it in front of a precision engineered lens and sort of gum up the works and give you less great results. Now, in the days of film, though, a UV filter would have cut out UV light that could have created haze in very long distance landscapes, and it did have a purpose then. And now they're just used as a clear filter to basically protect your lens and lower your image quality at the same time. So when I was selling cameras, I would opt to buy or to sell the person a lens hood instead of a UV filter, and they get all the, or at least most of the same protection qualities, and reduce lens flares and improve the quality of the image, and I don't know, it just looks cooler too.
You look like a rock star. You do.
You look like a rock star with a lens.
Unless you have it turned around backwards. You see the people walking around with it turned on backwards.
I hate that so much. It bothers me to no end.
Yep, that's fingernails on a chalkboard for me. Yeah. But what is more of a what is more useless, UV filter or extended warranty?
Extended warranty.
Okay, there you go. Those are the two upsells they always try to get you on.
Well, yeah, it's because you have to jump through so many hoops oftentimes to get that extended warranty. And the issue is it goes from the camera store to their warehouse, and then that gets shipped to the manufacturer, who then does some sort of magic, and maybe it sticks, maybe it's not, and you have no control over that. You have no direct communication to them. And then it goes back to the warehouse of the store, and then it goes back to the store. So it's 2.5-3 months later that you get your camera back, and it might be fixed or it might not. And it's just the frustration of not having your camera in hand when you can just the camera is gonna, if anything goes wrong with a camera or a lens, the cost, if it's just like a little part or a little chip or a little ribbon or something inside the camera that has broken, the cost is going to be pretty minimal to fix. And even still, I remember I saw somebody that had a Sigma has a number of lenses, and this one was their 300 to 800 millimeter lens. It's a beast. It's huge, and it costs a lot of money. They completely shattered the objective lens, the outer lens on this setup, and they sent it back to Sigma, and it cost them like $200 to have it repaired. Like, it was a small fraction of the cost of the lens. And the cost of buying a UV filter for that lens would have been like $350.
Yep, to shoot through a piece of glass, to shoot through a window.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I highly recommend that you do not buy a UV filter. That's what I've tell everybody. If you've already bought one, go ahead and take it off your camera. And I find the best, I do use lens hoods on everything, but the best protection for your camera is don't drop it.
Yeah, that's pretty smart.
Yeah, that's the way I go. And I've dropped my camera before, and I had a UV filter on, and it shattered the UV filter, left the lens. So it did work. It did its job. However, I've not replaced it. So what kind of filters do you recommend? Besides the circular polarizers, definitely the one that I've always kind of wanted in my bag.
The other big one that I always think about is a neutral density filter. And
we have a cooler name for that though.
An ND filter.
We call it an ND. Yeah.
Yeah. So an ND filter or neutral density filter for the technical people will stop light from coming into the camera. And you might be asking, well, why would you want to do that? Because light's usually a good thing, correct? But if you're trying to get a very slow shutter speed in very bright light, it's very hard if you're in bright sunlight and you're trying to get, say, a 1 second exposure to smooth out the flow of water in a waterfall. And your ISO will only go so low and your aperture will only get so small. And when you have those at their maximums, oftentimes you're still not slow enough to get that nice silky smooth effect.
Right.
So a neutral density filter in front of the camera will stop, say, half or more of the light from coming in and give you a little bit more flexibility in your exposure. So for some nature and landscape photography, that can be very valuable. In the video world, that can be huge too, so that you can be shooting outdoors in bright light with a wide aperture so that you get a nice shallow depth of field, but you can still maintain a slow enough shutter speed to keep things smooth instead of everything being all jerky.
Right, because generally I don't like to, when I shoot video, I don't go above 1/50th of a second.
Right, because if you do, then from one frame to the next, there's no blurring, and it just doesn't look natural.
Right, it's like, again, to go back to the beginning of movies, it's like the beginning of Saving Private Ryan.
Right.
Where there's that real staccato effect, and so I don't go above 1/50th because I'm shooting at 1/24th, I'm shooting at 24 frames per second. And when you're outside, the lowest the 5D you'll go to is 100, ISO 100.
Yep.
And so oftentimes you get a aperture of F8 or 11 when you want something much wider open.
Exactly.
And, much more wider.
You know, I think it's a rule, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're the expert in video, but you want to keep your shutter speed to be a multiple of the frames per second that you're shooting or close to it.
Well, as best you can. Normally, it's double,
right?
Because like when you shoot film and you shoot 24 frames per second, your shutter speed is automatically 1/48th of a second,
right?
And that's just the way it works. And if you want a faster shutter speed, you got to shoot more frames per second. That's just how the shutter works. It's a actual physical shutter. But now that we're using in the digital world, it is different. But I try to keep it to be identical, so it looks like there's a certain way that things move on camera that look normal to the viewer, and I don't want to deviate from that.
Well, because human vision isn't 1/8,000th of a second. You know, we don't see that quickly. So anything that's sort of outside of the way we see the world comes off as unnatural, and it just doesn't feel right, I guess.
Yep, it looks goofy. So do you know why it's called neutral density, Adam?
Sorry, I was sleeping there. No, I don't.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong. I believe it's that called that because it doesn't change the color of your image. It's basically sunglasses for your camera without adding any color effects.
Okay. I think you're right with that one. Yeah.
So this is something I do have. I don't have it. I dug out my old one. I have it on a 72 millimeter mount. What do you call it? What do you call the one with that, Don? It's a 72 millimeter.
72 millimeter what now?
When you wind it on, it's 72 millimeters in diameter.
Filter
thread, okay. I promise it really, I really got up at 5:15 to do the show. So I have an ND6 that's a 72 millimeter thread, which I don't have an adapter for to use on mine. So that's something I would use often, and I will use often. But that leads us into what is a different filter thread?
Well, here's a great tip that I always give to people, and that's that look at all the lenses that you've got. And typically, one lens will have a different filter thread from another, and that's the size of the filter and how it will fit onto the end of the camera. So if I'm shooting with my 100 to 400, which is a telephoto lens, it's going to have a 77 millimeter filter thread, which is pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if I'm shooting with my 50 millimeter lens, it's going to have a 58 millimeter, or some of them are 52 millimeter filter threads, which is much smaller.
So you can't use the same filter on those both lenses.
Well, see, this is what I do is as I look and see, well, 77 millimeter is my biggest filter thread. And so I buy all of my filters at 77 millimeter. And then I just buy a what's called a step-up ring. And that will screw into my 58 millimeter filter thread on one side and give me a 77 millimeter filter thread on the other. So right. This lets me use those big filters even on the smaller threads. And I think they cost like $4 on eBay. They're pretty cheap, so that you don't have to buy multiple filters of the exact same type. You can spend good money and get one good filter and use it on all of your lenses.
So you should spend money. If you're going to buy a filter, how much should you spend?
Well, I mean, how much is
in general terms
your lens cost? You know, I mean, if you're using a relatively inexpensive lens, I mean, don't go out and buy a filter that costs more than your lens. The polarizer that I have is from a company called B+W, which is one of the higher end brand names when it comes to filter quality. And I think it cost me over $300 for that filter. Okay. So some of them are expensive, and I'm sure that I could have spent more on it. But there's a certain point where there's a, you know, the law of diminishing returns. I could spend twice as much, and maybe it's 2% better. Mm-hmm. So it just really depends. But don't go for the bottom of the barrel thing and expect to get good results, because it's going to gum up the quality. There's basically two different styles of filters: single coated and multi coated filters. Do you have any experience with that, Alan?
Nope.
Okay.
So why don't you go ahead and run with that?
All right, I will. I'm not 100% certain on the details, and that's why I tried to throw it over to you, but I guess I'm stuck. So
here, I'll fill this one, Don.
Oh,
I'm playing solitaire over here.
Go ahead, Don.
No, you go ahead.
Okay. Do you want me to really go ahead?
Okay. Single coat has one coat.
If you have any idea what the answer could be, then go for it.
No, I don't. I have no idea.
Well, okay. I'll explain it best as I know. Is that a single coated filter will only have one layer of whatever magical coating they put on to remove things like lens flares and chromatic aberration, like color fringing around edges and things like that. So if you get a single-coated filter, those types of defects in your photos and ghosting and that sort of stuff are going to be a little bit more noticeable. Whereas a multi-coated filter has more layers of magic, and and they remove a lot of those defects as best as they can. So the more expensive filters are going to have more layers of magic in them.
Okay.
They call that MLM in the business.
That's more layers of magic. Yeah, exactly. There you go.
It's the technical term.
Yeah.
We try to keep it less technical here. So, okay, so if someone's going to go out, basically a beginner, and they're going to buy their first filter, we've already established don't buy a UV filter. Save your $40. What is the first filter that you'd recommend people buy?
Probably a polarizer.
Yeah, that's exactly what I would say. You're going to get the most use out of that. You're going to get the best... that's most bang for your buck, like they like to say. And that's where I'd go. You're not going to get away cheap on that one.
Compared to the UV filter that you're saving $40 on, a good polarizer is going to be at least 100 or more.
Right. My analogy I make with that is it's like sushi. You know, sure, you can find $3 all-you-can-eat sushi, but should you?
No.
Yeah, you know, pay a couple bucks more and don't get food poisoning. That's what I say with filters. So
yeah, poisonous filters are never good for anybody.
Exactly.
Now, I do want to mention one other filter that I've used and experimented with and I want to play around more with is an infrared filter.
Mm-hmm.
Have either of you played around with any of that?
No.
No. No.
Okay, I'm going solo again. All right.
like your prom. I don't know, Don. Maybe not.
There you go. I'll just take that. So an infrared filter will basically be completely black to your eye. If you see anything, it's a very, very faint dark red. And what it'll do is when you put that in front of your camera, it blocks all visible light, but it lets the infrared spectrum and the near-infrared spectrum come through, which is light that we can't see with our eyes. And typically a camera can't either, because there's a special filter that blocks it inside most cameras, because it doesn't help a regular photo. But if you have a relatively long exposure, you can get away with an infrared shot using an infrared filter on just your average camera. You'll just to throw out some settings there, you'd be shooting at a higher ISO and a long shutter speed in order to get a proper exposure. But you're then looking at the world that you can't see because you're looking at a different spectrum of light that's outside of what you can see with your own eyes. And I just find that fascinating because the sky becomes very, very dark and so does water. But mm-hmm. foliage, anything that's, you know, green, like leaves on trees, will glow bright white. Grass will glow bright white. So you get a very surreal world that you can't see, but it's always there. And that's sort of intriguing to me. And I've played around with it a little bit, but the filters are exorbitantly expensive.
Now, so is that something
you
that
make a commitment to it?
Can you fake that in post?
You can to a point, but when you're faking that in post, all you're doing is taking the blues and darkening them, and taking the greens and lightening them. So, like, let's say you've got a green truck next to a farm, and you've got green grass and green trees. In post, that truck is going to start glowing just like the trees. If you're doing a global filter, so you know you can go around and you can figure out different ways to do it. But it does different things that are less easy to I guess replicate in post, and that's if you're taking a photograph of a person, for example. Infrared light will often smooth out blemishes on skin. It makes your eyes look really freaky, but mm-hmm. it can smooth out skin tones. So I know some wedding photographers that use infrared filters for some of the shots where you can't directly see people's faces.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. But to do it in post, I mean, there are a whole bunch of software filters that you could use.
And it's like a one button click to do it. Yeah.
That's pretty much how it goes. If you're using, you know, Aperture or Lightroom or pretty much any program now, they're going to give you a lot of sort of like a filter set that's built in, and you could buy add-ons as well, which I haven't really done yet. I haven't really had the need for that. But when the two things that I use when I do software filters, when I filter for black and white, I shoot raw in color and then go to black and white, my default starting point is a yellow filter. For all those reasons that Don said earlier that I couldn't articulate, that's why. I like the skin tones. I like the basic the look of that. And from there I will use the sliders and kind of adjust how it to taste. But that's my starting point, is the yellow filter.
Beautiful.
Do you ever do black and white?
I do, but I rarely take photos of people in my photography, so I probably wouldn't use a yellow filter. But when I'm converting to black and white, typically I don't choose a filter to start with. I just start playing with the settings, and I'm a fan of high contrast black and white and playing around with texture and that sort of stuff, and that's sort of my game. And I'll just bring up that I use Lightroom as my main processor for that sort of stuff. And I'll click around in the hue, saturation, luminance section, the HSL. Mm-hmm. And it's really quite powerful in Lightroom because you can grab the whatever the – there's a selection tool for each of those. And I can just grab that tool, move over part of the photo that I want to make lighter or darker, and then just move my mouse left or right, or is it up and down. And it will make that – that color in the photo, even though I'm seeing it in black and white, everything that color will increase in brightness or decrease in brightness, and it can be quite powerful.
And that's where the software filters come in. Adam, have you experimented with that yet?
With the software filters? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do exactly what Don says, but in Aperture, spend a lot of time fiddling around with the saturation of particular colors. You showed me how to do that a while back, and I love it.
That's my fake polarizer move, the poor man's polarizer.
Yeah.
PMP,
well,
we call
that. Well, it doesn't work for the sky, but it won't get rid of your reflection.
No, it doesn't. That's why it's the poor man's version. It does a little bit. Basically, what I do is I select the blues and kind of crank up the saturation a little bit and bring down the luminance a little.
Yeah.
And what you'll find is you get that darkening of the sky. It doesn't make the clouds pop quite the same. It doesn't make the sky.
No, but I mean, you can carry that farther and use a localized clarity adjustment brush and getting technical and all that sort of stuff. It can be done in a few extra steps. But again, it's a poor man's filter because it doesn't do quite the same thing.
Right. It's not quite the same, but in a pinch, I do recommend people trying something like that if you want to darken the sky a little bit.
Especially for photos that you've already taken that you want to try and make them better.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Or oftentimes worse.
That too, yeah.
As it
I've
ends
seen
up
way
happening.
Too many overprocessed photos that just look like clown puke.
Well, there you go. Yeah, that you see a lot of that online. So wrapping up, I got to tell you, if you want to, you know, do really good work, get a hardware filter. Start with a UV, or stop with the UV. Stop. That's what's in front of me. Stop with the UV. Save your money. Put it towards a circular polarizer, or if you're going to shoot video, get an ND filter. I think you'll probably find that in the near future they'll be built into the camera, because that's kind of as video merges into still photography more, because video cameras mostly have ND built in, which would be sort of like a rear element filter.
Some point and shoots have that now too.
Do they?
Yep.
So there you go. So it's kind of making its way in, but that's where I would look. Start with the polarizer and move on. So there you go. Anybody got a challenge for next week?
I think I might have one, but before I get there, I want to mention one more thing about filters quickly. And this is my very first experience with filters, and my very first camera, if you could call it a camera, was the Game Boy camera. Has anybody ever seen or played with one of those?
Adam, you're the best bet here.
No, I know the Game Boy well, the original Game Boy, but
no, it was for the original Game Boy. It was a camera for the original Game Boy, and it was a black and white camera. It would store 30 pictures, and the resolution was 140 pixels by 140 pixels.
Nice.
And it was black and white. So I took this camera and I wanted to make some color photos with it. So, and you can do this with any camera today. You can set just your average digital SLR to black and white and take the exact same shot with a green filter in front of the camera, a red filter in front of the camera, and a blue filter in front of the camera. And you can add those together as separate channels in Photoshop and get a color shot. So back when I was, I don't know how old I was, probably 7 or 8, I bought a little printer adapter that would allow me to connect it up to my computer. And I was taking color pictures with this old black and white camera back then using filters. Wow. And so you can take black and white and make it color by doing it that way. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that's how The Wizard of Oz was filmed.
Wow. And
when I was 7 or 8, I was watching cartoons and eating candy.
Off the floor.
I did a bit of that too.
Yeah.
Off and the floor, yeah.
So, and Don, you have a fiance, right?
I do, yes.
Wow. Okay.
It's all coming together.
Yeah.
Wow.
Don't be too shocked.
I guess she, yes, yeah. It's a strange world in Barrie. Okay.
All right.
We're not really ripping on you. That's actually impressive that you go with the three filters and make a color image. That is very impressive.
Plus, you're smarter than I am.
Yeah. Adam and I combined.
I mean, I wouldn't know the first thing how to heal a sprained ankle, but I'm sure that you could school me on that, Adam.
Yes, I could help you out there.
I believe you rub dirt on it and walk it off.
Toughen up, cupcake. Yeah. That's what you say.
Wait a second. I just paid $75 to hear toughen up, cupcake. Yeah. Is that covered?
Yes. You get it back.
All right, Don, your photo challenge.
All right. So this is a bit of an interesting one that everybody can do, and it's worth playing around with. Is take whatever lens you have on your camera right now, flip it around, and take a picture. So take the lens off the camera, physically hold it in front of the camera backwards, and you now have a macro lens.
Okay.
Sounds fun.
I want people to try and do some very close focusing stuff with that and see what you can do. Different camera manufacturers will function a little bit differently. So in Canon, if you try and do this, the aperture will be completely open. So you'd be shooting at the widest that lens could do. Nikon will be shooting completely closed. So you'd be shooting at f/22 or whatever. So you might need a little bit more light. But it's sort of a poor man's macro lens where you can flip a camera, a lens around, and just play around with some close-up photography. And I want to see what people come up with.
Awesome. I will accept that challenge.
I accept.
There we go. That's great. Well, that's the end of brings us to the end of the show. Before we go, though, where can people start with you, Adam? Where can people find you?
SchwartzChronicles.com.
Wonderful. Any good pictures up there?
Always.
Awesome. People can find me at AlanAttridge.com, as always. And the two of us are the TwoHosers.com. And everything you want to find is there. So look for us for iTunes and that. And Don, outdoor photography...
Phil Sims. Well, I'll actually point people towards my portfolio website if I can, which is doncom.ca, D-O-N-K-O-M.ca. And I've actually been doing a project on Google Plus right now, and that's a snowflake a day. So I'm posting one snowflake photograph every single day until I get to 100 pictures, which will be sometime in March. So check that out if you get a chance to.
You're going to have snow in March?
Well, I hope so.
But, are you posting them, or are you taking one every day?
I wish I could take one every day, but we don't get snow every day, at least not this year. So I might take 10 in a day and then post those over the course of a week or so. And then when the next snowfall comes, I'll freshen up.
You don't get snow every day?
No.
Thanks a lot, Al Gore.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's great. So look for Don there, and I think we can all find you on there. Google Don Komarechka. That's all you got to do.
Yeah. Oh, if you could spell my last name, anyhow.
There you go. So that's it. Until next week, get out there and make better photos.